The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have an exciting discussion topic and guest for you today, one that I've been very interested in for a long, long time, probably since watching Star Trek, if you want to know the truth. But more about our guest, Dr. Gerald Jackson, and antimatter propulsion potentials in just a minute. A couple of quick announcements to get us started with the Space Show. So we're doing a full 90-minute discussion today, but still, watch the clock. And if you do want to call and talk to Dr. Jackson or send us an email, make sure you do it so that it gets to us in time that we're still on the air and that we haven't already closed the program down for the day. So again, I urge you to watch the clock, even though we're back to the full 90-minute schedule today. And then a comment about the coming week. We have six programs again planned for you. So Dr. Lopez is on with us Monday evening about his unusual planetary protection, a policy that we have been talking about on the show for a couple of weeks, in that he thinks we should be spreading earthly molecules all through the solar system, not to worry about contamination, especially get them over to Mars. And he has an academic reviewed paper on that, and Dr. Lopez will be with us for that topic. Tuesday night, we're looking at some advanced human factors issues for human spaceflight with Dr. John Jurist and Linda Plush. Hotel Mars, Bill Harwood of CBS News is back with us, and Bachelor wants to talk about the all-female spacewalk that was recently concluded. Then, as usual, Friday Space Show program. Thursday night Space Show program with a space architect who spoke at the Space Studies Institute conference, Susanna Bianco. And that's Thursday night. Friday morning, and then Sunday, open lines. So it's a full Space Show week. And we hope you're with us for everything we talk about and do this coming week. Our toll-free number for today, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. We do answer the phone during the break and put you on hold. So if you want to call us, don't let the upcoming break stop you from doing that. You can also reach us by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and our blog, which is off of our website. And if you need blog instructions, email me and I'll send them to you. They're very short, but I'll tell you how to do it. But the preferred way is, since we're a talk show, talking with us, and that involves our toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. The website newsletter for the week will be posted after this program ends today. Make sure you check out all of what we're doing for the week, but also scroll down and see the programs we have planned through the balance of the year. And we don't have very many spots left for 2019, but we do have a few. If you have a guest you'd like to recommend, please do that. And we are also starting in on the first quarter of 2020's schedule. Everything we do is archived, and you can download shows very quickly. The file size is not that big, or you can listen right off of our website. And, of course, we're podcasting in multiple formats, iTunes and TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcast, Overcast, most all of the Android, Google phone lines and phone tablet. Their podcast apps have our Space Show program as well. If you have any questions, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. www.spaceshowpodcast.com. Don't forget to check the upper left menu. So Listen Live does tell you how to listen to live shows like we're doing right now. It tells you how to listen to the compressed archives on our website and then how to listen to the podcast. Many of those players are embedded on our website. But again, if you have questions, always email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Then I want to direct you over to the, what I think is a really, really important part of the show, and that is that the Space Show is listener-supported, which means we're able to do this program and bring you great guests, and I really mean it when I'm talking about our guests today, because you help financially support and keep the Space Show going. So remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3, and by the way, we really are a 501c3. We have been one and also a California Public Benefit Corporation for coming up on 10 years. And if anybody wants that IRS or nonprofit information, I'm more than happy to share that with you. I do know a lot of people call themselves nonprofits, but they're really not. So I just want to assure everybody we really and truly are a nonprofit. And that's why we use the .org on OneGiantLeapFoundation.org's website. But your support is really important, and if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift, and if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction for your gift. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and you can check it out at that website address. Also, you may be interested in being an advisory board member. That information is at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org as well. And then on our website, you'll see a big PayPal button on the right side, upper part of our website. This tells you how to donate to us via PayPal electronically. If you want to use a check and snail mail, that information is also on that PayPal button. So that is your choice, and we appreciate your support. We also have a very big Amazon button in the middle of the page, and that's because Amazon does have great nonprofit support programs, and we're registered with both of them. And if you click on that link, it takes you to our Amazon page on One Giant Leap Foundation's page and tells you how you can just do your normal routine Amazon shopping. And if you do it through our portal, which Amazon assigns to us, or the Smile site for Amazon, they donate a portion of your purchase price to the Space Show. So it's a great way to support us just by doing whatever you do on Amazon, assuming you do shop and buy things from Amazon. And we certainly appreciate your Amazon support. Holidays are upon us. Don't forget that we have a store. And so for your favorite Space Cadet or Space Show listener, you might be interested in our logo wear type of item. To get there, click on any of the photographs on the website of Pepper, the Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show, and Pepper will guide you to our Cafe Press store. And we thank you for that, excuse me, very, very much. And again, we thank you for your support. We're about to start our 2019 end of the year, going into 2020 fundraising campaign. Remember, we've been using our funding from this year and the end of last year to get us this far. Now it's time to replenish the coffers, so to speak, and take us into a robust 2020. So we certainly look forward to your support as we get ready to start our campaign early in November. And a couple of things about our guest today. I first came across antimatter propulsion as a potential reality at the Space Access Society conference, which was held in Fremont, California around Easter time. And it was presented by a different person with a different company. But up to that point, I hadn't given antimatter as propulsion much of an interest on any level, because I just didn't think that it was plausible. Then at ISDC, Dr. Zubrin ran a great track, which I attended, and he had antimatter propulsion speaker who did a terrific job with charts and graphs, and I wish we were visible here on radio to help us understand what he was talking about, Dr. Gerald Jackson. And his company is HBAR Technologies, LLC. You can access their website, HBAR Tech, H, letter H, B-A-R, and then tech.com. And his associate is Dr. Stephen Howe, H-O-W-E, who has been a guest many times on the Space Show in the past, but about nuclear propulsion, not antimatter propulsion. It's really a pleasure to talk to Dr. Jackson here on the Space Show. I caught up with him in the hallway after his ISDC presentation and invited him to the show. He's most gracious and friendly, and we've exchanged a few emails, and he's way beyond my understanding of physics. I mean, it's like being on another planet with Dr. Jackson. But I think he can bring it down so that all of us, including me, can understand what he's talking about and the plausibility of it all and maybe even the timelines of it all. Dr. Jackson, it's a true honor to have you on the show. By the way, listeners, his full bio is on the website. His doctorate is in accelerator physics from Cornell. He has been associated with and accomplished unbelievable things with the Fermi Lab for years. Since 2000, he has founded many different companies. One is the Antimatter Propulsion Company. He's been funded with crowdfunding on antimatter, works with NASA. You really need to read his full bio that I have posted to understand the magnitude of his accomplishments and the fact that he's not a fringe flake talking about antimatter protection. He's the real thing, guys and gals. So, Gerald, again, we honor you and welcome you to the Space Show. How are you today?
Well, I'm great. Thank you very much for the gracious introduction. I appreciate it.
All deserved, and it's really great talking to you after your presentation at ISDC, which I must admit I didn't understand much of. So everything I've learned about physics comes from the Space Show, and not too many people talk about antimatter propulsion. They like to talk about nuclear, but antimatter really intrigues me. So let's start out with you introducing us to us. What actually is it, and what would antimatter propulsion really look like if it existed? And for those of us that are on Star Trek fans, we always thought that if you had antimatter come in contact with each other, it'll annihilate the universe. So what's going on here?
Okay, so antimatter is basically the same as regular matter, just a mirror image. And as, you know, there's yin and yang, black and white, I mean, good and evil, you know, there seems to be this duality in the universe across the spectrum. And it's the same is true for matter and charge. For instance, you have positive charges and negative charges, north poles and south poles. And in the case of matter, you have regular matter and antimatter. So if I take a proton, it has a certain mass and it has a positive charge. If I look at the antiproton, it has the exact same mass as the proton, but negative charge. So you can think of it maybe as the opposite pole of a magnet. But basically what happens is that if a proton and an antiproton come in contact, you get the famous E equals mc squared from Einstein. And so the two masses that compose the proton and the antiproton combine, multiply by C squared, and you get a certain amount of energy released. Now, that energy comes out in the form, in the case of protons and antiprotons, that energy comes out in the form of other elementary particles, gamma rays, pi mesons, things like that. And so, in the case of propulsion, what it is we're trying to do is use that energy release from the annihilation process to do something useful. Okay, and so it turns out that if you look at chemical energy, you know, you get an EV or so of energy per atom. If you look at nuclear, you get about an MeV of energy per particle. In the case of matter and antimatter, when they annihilate, you get GeV of energy. So you another three orders of magnitude. So you're nine orders of magnitude more energy released per particle than you get with chemical energy. So that is why in the days of Star Trek and, you know, in the literature, there's always been, people always go back to antimatter as being, you know, this ultimate energy source. So the question really is, how do you do something useful with that energy that comes out of that annihilation process? And Steve Howe, when he recruited me from Fermilab, It wanted, initially Steve Howe came to Fermilab to ask for some antiprotons to do some tests for this propulsion system. And I was assigned to be his liaison as a member of the Fermilab staff. And in the end, he ended up recruiting me away from Fermilab, and the rest is history. He's been my mentor along the way, so it's been a very rewarding relationship. And what he came up with was the idea that, and this is measured, okay, if you take an antiproton and let it come into contact with a uranium atom, because the antiproton has a negative charge like an electron, it goes into orbit around the uranium. So it takes the place of an electron. So it bumps out an electron, becomes one of those electrons, but now because it doesn't share the same quantum numbers as an electron, it can cascade all the way down to the ground state. And in the ground state, it overlaps the nucleus, interacts with either a proton or a neutron in the uranium nucleus, and causes an annihilation. In that annihilation, that energy is released in the form of the pi mesons. On average, one of those pi mesons gets absorbed by the nucleus, and it's like ringing a bell. The energy of that pi meson shakes the nucleus and causes it to fission. And so then you get two fission daughters on average that tear away from each other at about 100 MeV each. And in this propulsion system, what we propose to do is use that velocity of those fission daughters as the thrust. So that's the reaction mass that's leaving the spacecraft, and that's what's pushing the spacecraft forward.
How do you contain all of this, or does it even need to be contained?
Okay, so the original idea was actually very elegant. So Steve Howe's vision is that if you're going to send a small unmanned probe out to, let's say, Alpha Centauri, or Proxima Centauri, actually.
Okay.
So let's say you're going to send a probe out to Proxima Centauri. You want to get there in a human lifetime, let's say. So let's say you want to get there in 50 years. So that means you have to travel at 10% of the speed of light. Okay. If you look at the rocket equation, which dictates how, you know, the relationship between the spacecraft velocity and the exhaust velocity that comes out of the back of the spacecraft, for a reasonable rocket where the fuel mass is comparable to the dry mass, you know, the instrument package, the exhaust velocity has to be about the same as the desired ship velocity. So that says that if you want to go at 10% of speed of light, your particles that you're emitting out of the nozzle have to come out at around 10% of speed of light. Now, you can add more fuel and change that a little bit. So instead of 10%, maybe 5% or 2.5%. But as long as it's kind of within a factor of 3 and 4, you can get up to these sort of light fractions of the speed of light. So in this case, let's say 10%. So Steve's vision was that if you're trying to send, let's say, a 10-kilogram instrument package to Proxima B, which is the habitable planet that's orbiting Proxima Centauri right now, that you want a propulsion system that's mass is comparable to the spacecraft mass, the instrument package. So that means you don't want your propulsion system to weigh much more than the 10 kilograms that your instrument package is. So the idea was, so how can you do this? How can you passively create something very lightweight that can cause fission daughters to go out the back and propel the spacecraft forward? And so his vision was a sail. So the sail is made up of depleted uranium. So in this case, you don't need enriched uranium. You can just use regular uranium ore or depleted uranium, the thing we make bullets out of in armor. So it's not threatening. There's no atomic, explosion risk. It can't be used for weapons or anything like that. So a very safe form of uranium. You make a sail out of this. and now you have a little storage bottle of antiprotons where you send them out and let them at very, very slow kind of thermal type energies interact with the cell. And then because the antiprotons stop almost immediately on the surface, they cause this fission process to occur. The fission daughters go out back toward the back of the ship, and it pulls the sail forward, and you accelerate the spacecraft. So it's a very, very simple vision. So that part of it we know works. We know about the slowing down of antiprotons when they hit a target. We know experimentally how the fission process works. We know exactly how the fission daughters come off. So that part of this is completely non-controversial. Storage of antimatter and forming enough of it is where the issue arises.
Okay, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, did I time out?
No, I just heard a lot of clicking and static, so.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, so it's really the formation and storage of the antimatter where the technical risk is and where we have to do the experiments and show that we can make this work. Now, all the little pieces, portions of this have already been demonstrated, like at Fermilab where we make antiprotons, or we used to make, sorry. We used to make antiprotons at Fermilab. So all the little pieces have been shown. It's now a matter of putting it together a program and producing enough fuel to actually do one of these trips to support a mission.
So where are you in, well, if Fermi doesn't make it anymore, where do you get your supply of antimatter proteins, for example?
Okay, so right now, there is no source. I mean, they still make a few antiprotons at the CERN laboratory in Switzerland, but nowhere near enough. At its peak, Fermilab used to produce 2 nanograms per year. And that may not seem like a lot, but it actually would be enough to treat most people, most cancer cases for gliomas, for instance. In the world, so that's a lot of antiprotons, but not enough compared to what you need for a space mission like this. It turns out crossing the interstellar void to get to another star at 10% of the speed of light with a 10-kilogram instrument package requires a ton of kinetic energy, and so the real problem in human history has not been the generation of power, electrical power or energy. It's been the storage of it. So, for instance, if you look at the grid, the power you use out of your wall plug is created at the time you're using it. There's literally no storage mechanism on the grid. And, you know, the battery technology has only increased incrementally in the last 100 or 200 years. It has a really... we haven't really made major progress, and that's what's been limiting, you know, electric cars and a lot of renewable energy on the grid and things like that. So the real key here in the use of the antimatter is as an energy storage mechanism. So the idea is that you would have to use electricity to make the antiproton, store it up, and then you use it on board, and it's in a very light form, so you have a very high specific energy. So now you take that on the spacecraft, and especially for deceleration, have to let it sit there stably for 50, 100 years, whatever the cruise velocity is, let's say 50 years, and then use it to decelerate when you get to Proxima Centauri.
And then you used up all of your fuel, so then what?
Well, you don't use it all up. It's like when you go to, when Apollo went to the moon, most of the fuel was used getting up out of the Earth's atmosphere. A little bit more was used getting to the moon. You still had a little bit left to get back to Earth, and then you used the parachute to land. Okay, and so It takes a lot less fuel to actually tinker, you know, go kind of cruise around that solar system than it does to slow down. Again, most people don't have a good conception of just how fast 10% of the speed of light is and how how many orders of magnitude that's different from velocities involved in moving around within a solar system. It's like three orders of magnitude difference. So what you do is you basically, you know, use up 99% of your tank, and then the other 1% of the tank you can, you know, tool around the other solar system for a century.
So when the people from Breakthrough have been on the show, and they talk about using lasers to propel their little tiny wafers that are less than 10 milligrams that you're talking about probably, they're talking about 20 to 25% the speed of light.
Right.
So whether that's possible or not, who knows? But
even I will grant them that. Even if you say, sure, we'll do that. What are you going to? I mean, my problem is, how do you do any science? Now, I'm a scientist. Okay, uh-huh. I am a hardcore scientist. My whole career in accelerator physics is about making things actually work. I'm an employee of the particle physicists who try to discover the top quark and the Higgs particle and things like that. My job is to create the tools by which they could do that science. Similarly, as a rocket science, my job is to make the tools so that the planetary scientists and astronomers could do their science, okay?
Uh-huh.
There's no point in sending something to Proxima Centauri if you can't, A, do any science, and B, report back the results. Okay. And while I am sure it is possible to build a bank of lasers and to accelerate something up to 10, 20, I don't know about 25, but up to 20% of the speed of light, what you do when it gets there, I don't think they've addressed that at all.
Well, no, I can tell you what they say on the show, that they can't slow down, they can't stop, they can't wave hello, they just keep going.
Right, but the question is, in that few minutes that you're in that, remember, at that velocity, there's no bending. It's a straight ballistic shot through that solar system.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and so, I mean, I don't understand. You could maybe you could take a picture, though. I mean, I've done the back of the envelope calculations, and if you look at, you know, Messenger for Mercury looking at Earth, if you look at Hubble, if you look at all these spacecraft and their telescopes and what they're able to resolve, I don't know. They haven't really addressed that in their literature. Actually, what they could do. Plus, you're going so fast that you're blue shifted, and the zooming effect. I mean, you're coming at that planet so fast. The blurring, I just don't understand how you're going to do that measurement. So even a simple photograph, I don't understand how they think they're going to be able to do it. But that's why you do research, right? Maybe someday they'll come up with an answer. My job right now is to take known laws, known experimental facts, and come up with something that I know works without magic wands. Okay? For me to start a project that has a magic wand embedded is a waste of time, because I'll never get that device to work if there's a magic wand in it.
You have your initial email question is our friend Todd, who is in San Diego. And he said, for those of us that are captivated by Hollywood's interstellar movies and would like to do an interstellar mission on a sleeper ship or something like that, you're talking about such tiny mass that it doesn't seem like you'd ever have enough antimatter or anything else for that matter to take 100 people, let alone more than that, on an interstellar mission to another planet. Is there any way any of what you're talking about could be ramped up for human interstellar flight?
Of course, but it's not going to happen the first shot. I mean, this is good. So let me back up. What's a good analogy? So when they first started working the Manhattan Project, they needed enriched uranium to make the bomb. Okay. Well, they knew that they could differentially sift and separate U-235 from U-238, for instance, okay? And they did it, you know, in very, very, very small samples. But then, you know, and this is talking about femtograms, okay, and they were able to do it, say, okay, fine, we know how to do this. And now, you know, the military said, yeah, but we need something big enough to blow up a city. And so all of a sudden now you're looking at 12 orders of magnitude of mass. And so how are you going to separate that much isotope? And so, you know, initially they built a, you know, a separating, you know, what do you call those things, centrifuge. And then they built two, then they built 10, then they built entire factories full of them. And then they built multiple of those factories. If you look at, you know, in the semiconductor era, when we were kids, they first came out with transistor radios. And those transistors were very expensive, and they were, you know, a grain of salt, okay? And that was all they could produce at the time. Now they're making square miles of solar panels, okay? So I don't doubt human ingenuity and the ability to, once something is proven and shown to be of desired, you know, either through economics or some other metric, but once it's desired by a large enough people, then it can happen. Okay, in this case, you're not going to get that sort of investment and that sort of expenditure on this project until you could show it working on a smaller scale. And that's why right now we're going to concentrate on unmanned probes, because that is something that's already challenging enough. 200 years from now, 300 years from now, will we be able to ramp that up enough to do humans? Yes. I'm sure we will. I'm sure we'll figure that out. Also, there's another pathway, and this was the subject of NIAC, so NASA Innovative Concepts, Advanced Concepts proposal we did back in 2004 or 5, I think it was, where we talked about harvesting antiprotons that already exist in space. And it turns out there are the cosmic rays coming in and striking the solar wind protons are already producing antiprotons. And we've measured those antiprotons in with space-based detectors in Earth orbit. So we already know there's antiprotons up there. So the point of this NIAC proposal was to study whether we could build a harvester that basically goes through, you know, the solar system, collecting up all these antiprotons and, you know, getting rid of the chaff. In this case, the chaff would be normal matter and anything else that you don't want to keep.
And you can do that?
Well, we certainly studied it. The problem with NIAC funding, which is wonderful, it's the only form, really the only form of funding that's out there right now through the government for these sorts of topics, is that you only get funded for 9 months or, you know, a year or two, and then it goes away. And it's very hard to develop any continuity. So even though we were funded in 2004, 5, up through, I think, 2006 on that one, it hasn't been worked on since. So it's been 13 years sitting on the shelf during dust just because there's no financial support to continue it.
So going back to something you said earlier, if there's very little antimatter substance being made today, how do you even plan on doing research?
The answer to your question is you work backwards. And let me explain a little bit how that works. So right now, so the idea is that you want to store the antiprotons as molecular solid snowflakes, basically a snowball of solid hydrogen, antihydrogen, molecular antihydrogen. So, and the reason you need to do that is because you need to have a neutral mass of the antiproton. So you have to pair up each antiproton with a positron, the antimatter version of the electron. And so, and it turns out that all the physical properties of regular matter are the same as antimatter. So the boiling point of solid, or the sublimation temperature, sublimation rate of molecular antihydrogen is the same as regular hydrogen. And so the idea is, we know we need a certain amount of mass stored on, of antimatter stored on the ship. So the idea is, we're going to create that same amount of mass in a regular hydrogen snowball, show that we can make it last and not sublimate away. So in this case, what we've looked at is an encapsulation process with, in the case of anti-hydrogen, we encapsulate that snowball with anti-lithium. And so we've worked through how do you go and make anti-lithium from the anti-hydrogen. And so it's basically nuclear fusion. And so you set up a bunch of accelerators, and for about a tenth of a percent of the antimatter, you make anti-lithium, and you create a shell like the candy coating of an M&M's. Okay, so you create a shell around the volatile anti-hydrogen so it doesn't sublimate away, like dry ice sublimates away. And so what you do is you work backwards. So we know that we need a certain amount of, now instead of antimatter, regular matter, we know we need to store a certain amount of solid hydrogen. So we're going to do that. And then we're going to do this, use the same techniques that we were going, so we take a hydrogen source, make lithium as a beam, coat that hydrogen snowball with the lithium, and therefore show that we can make the fuel form we need that can be stable over 50 years and not sublimate away in that 50 years while you're coasting through space. So the idea is we're going to do all these things that, again, also remove technical risk. I mean, the technical risk in this case has nothing to do with antimatter. It has to do with how do you store solid hydrogen. Okay, and so the idea is we're going to do these simpler things first. As we show that we can do all, you know, do each step, we take away some of the technical risk, we make it more realistic, and so it's easier for us to get more funding. As we build up all these accelerators to do all this stuff for regular matter, all you have to do is flip the polarity, and now you could use those exact same accelerators for antimatter. And so ultimately, at the very end of this process, what you're going to do is build a much, much smaller set of accelerators to produce the antimatter than you used at Fermilab. Fermilab used a very complicated and very expensive way of producing antimatter because of the form that the antiprotons needed to be in order to collide them and create Higgs particles and top quarks and things like that. That constraint is removed when we talk about creating fuel. And so we could use much, much simpler and much more inexpensive and smaller footprint accelerator complex to make that happen. And so the idea is that we're going to, again, with a snowball analogy, we're going to, you know, grow the snowball as we go along and start with this inexpensive, simple stuff and work our way back toward producing the antimatter when we show that all other technical risk has been removed.
Jerry, how did you and your peers figure all this stuff out? I'm assuming there's no textbook that says step one, do this, step two, do this, step three, do this. How do you know all this stuff? To the non-physicist, you know, what you're talking about is an unbelievable amount of knowledge and practice and experimentation spanning probably lifetimes to be able to know how to do what you're talking about over the last 5 minutes. How do you get that? It isn't from going to school at Cornell. I mean, I don't even know how to ask the question, but where does this knowledge and expertise of how to do this come from?
Okay, so I mean, it's a good question, and my kids have asked me that question over the years just with relationship to their own lives. I mean, I have a daughter who just finished aerospace engineering at University of Michigan and just started her new job at Boeing. And, you know, over the years, she's asked me that sort of question also. How do you get to know enough to be useful in any given field? And a lot of it has to do with making a commitment rather early on and then following that commitment through. So when I was 8 years old, I decided I wanted to do engineering. And when I was 11 years old, I started building Estes rockets, and I fell in love with science. And grew up on a farm, so that helped. So I, you know, had access to a welder, and you know, I was driving a car by myself on the back roads when I was 8 years old. So you know, a lot of it is just sort of the freedom to try things out and not suffer any consequences when things go bad, and having parents who were very forgiving when you set fire to the house or blew something up. And just a lot of it is just being sort of not single-minded, but very serious about or being intellectually curious and serious about things. When I was in high school and earlier, I was an avid science fiction writer. But I could probably count on two hands the number of books I've read since I turned 20, sci-fi books, just because of the every day I put in probably 16 hours studying, calculating, doing this sort of work. I mean, that said, I showed up to every single track meet and cross-country meet of my daughter had. You know, I'm tutoring my son, you know, in the evenings here on electronics. So, I mean, I'm still, you know, a father and a husband and so on. But when it comes to my professional career, it's been, you know, very, very single-minded and also loving it. Just enjoying every day, enjoying learning, enjoying interacting with people. I mean, I must say that I'm privileged that I was able to interact with really great people who were great leaders in the field of science and engineering. I mean, a lot of my professors were in the Manhattan Project. Many of my professors, well, I know probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 Nobel Prize winners, personally interacted with several of them. I'm still friends with some of the professors I had when I was an undergraduate who are well-known authors and have books and TV series and so on. So this ability to interact with really great minds and to tap into them, like Steve Howe was a great example of somebody who got me to change gears from accelerator physics and started looking at rocket science.
You have a phone call waiting. Let's talk to your caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
Usual place. Earlier, you talked about a snowball, and my immediate thought was some kind of Bose-Einstein condensate. Is that kind of what you're thinking about, is the snowball?
No, I'm actually talking about a real snowball. So molecular hydrogen, van der Waal forces, you know, sticking together. It's a solid up until about 10 degrees Kelvin. Above that, it starts sublimating away as individual gas molecules. The problem with something like a boson condensate is that it is very, very hard to hold something like that together with real densities and once you get up to large scales. Okay, I mean, we can make, you know, condensates on a small scale, but in order to have them survive launch to, you know, I mean, you can imagine just vibration and all the other things that go into this. Those are very, very hard things to hold together. And so, I mean, we did consider it once. In fact, we have papers on it and we've done extensive studies. But in the end, we've always come back to how do you make this simple, okay? How do you make it stupid?
Mm-hmm.
So, because when it comes to engineering, when you make the transition from something on the bench to something in the real world, if it isn't really simple, it's really hard to make it work in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking Bose-Einstein constants, whenever they make them, they're always matter. And the idea of using antimatter to do it, I kind of go, okay. And then you talked about using anti-lithium, and I have never read anything about mixing different elements together to modify a Bose-Einstein condensate to, you know, be more stable. So there isn't any real stability in adding, I'm trying to think, boron or carbon or, you know, some other elements to it to make it more stable.
Right. So this is not a stability argument. This is forming a bottle around the snowball so that you don't lose the anti-hydrogen molecules that boil off the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So this is
it's a storage issue.
So it's a long-term storage issue, and how do you make an antimatter bottle? Okay, and so it turns out you're familiar, I'm sure, with ion implantation of silicon for making N-type, mm-hmm. E-type semiconductors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you basically do the same thing, but a much lower energy ion beam, so that the ion beam just coats the surface and creates a surface shell. And so it's actually the exact same physics, the exact same beam dynamics, just at much lower energy. And so what you're doing is it turns out that there's going to be a thin layer between the lithium and the hydrogen, which is molecular lithium hydride. And you can't help it. That's just what happens. So you have the 99% of the mass is this snowball, and then you have a very, very thin transition layer of lithium hydride, and then beyond that you have the lithium. And because lithium melts at room temperature, basically a little bit above room temperature, it boils at much, much higher, that doesn't sublimate away, so now you've removed your storage issue. So the only trick was, are there accelerator physics techniques wherein I could make antiprotons into antideuterons, collide antideuterons with antiprotons to make antilithium-3, and you work your way up the periodic table until you get to antilithium-7. And we have shown, using standard fusion cross-sections and experimentally verified fusion reactions, that you can get there. We've set up what the accelerator chain looks like, and we've shown that you can do that.
Very interesting. I'd like to come in there and make a comment about why do we do this kind of thing? And my comment is it's a form of art. Just like Rembrandt or Galileo, it's art. And we take the equations, we put them together, and we produce something inherently beautiful all by itself.
How do I hang it on the wall, Marshall?
I'm sorry. I made lots of extremely beautiful software. It sits in a computer and sits there and runs, and we sit there and go, oh, that's beautiful. And, yeah, you got a point there. Can't hang it on the wall. Can't hardly explain it to anybody, but it's beautiful.
And I agree completely with that sentiment. You know, if I go back and I read Sorelli's literature about sound waves, where he did his first work with sound waves, I mean, if you're reading a work of art, it's just gorgeous. And the reason he did that was to pass something on to posterity. And I view a lot of what I'm doing right. I mean, I'll never see the probe. I probably will never see it even launch. I know I won't be around when it gets there to Proxima Centauri. But that's not the reason. I'm not doing this because I want to see it. I'm doing it because I want my great-great-grandchildren to someday not be just existing, chewing cud on some field. I want them to be living, to be human, to actually be growing and give something to mankind so that we can constantly be growing and moving forward and someday getting to our destination, whatever God determined that destination to be. And so I don't need to see some direct application right now. What I need to believe is that what I'm doing will someday be useful.
Yeah, perfect. I love it. Anyway, I've had enough fun for today.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Listeners, Marshall has freed up the line. If you want to call, it is 1-866-687-7223. I have an email from John in Fremont, California. Hi, Gerald. Well, this could actually be him calling because I sort of chastised him for sending an email rather than calling us. Let me take the call, and then I'll read his email if it's not him. So hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is John of Fremont.
Ah, good. I was just about to read your email. So now you can go in person. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Gerald. I drafted a question on the blog, but you pretty much, I think, answered it. But I kind of want to understand this storage bottle. Is it made out of antimatter?
Okay. So antimatter and matter annihilate if they touch. So what you first have to do is you have to levitate the antimatter in a vacuum. So on Earth, you have to have a vacuum chamber, and then you have to use electromagnetic fields to levitate it. Okay, now in space, you already have a pretty good vacuum, so you don't need anywhere near the wall thicknesses or the mass to store it. So it's a much simpler bottle in space, especially when you're in interstellar space where you're already down very close to absolute zero. So that portion of it is rather straightforward. So, but still there is, you know, you have computers, you have telescopes, you have all the other instrumentality that goes with a spacecraft that's nearby the fuel. And so that, you don't want antiprotons just, you know, actually more precisely, you don't want anti-hydrogen molecules boiling off the surface and being lost and interacting with the instruments around the fuel. So for that reason, you want to prevent this sublimation process. And the simplest way to do that is to encapsulate the antimatter with another form of antimatter that doesn't sublimate. And so that's where this anti-lithium shell comes from.
So you're still levitating
the anti-lithium
with magnetic fields.
Yeah, right? Or electrostatically or magnetically, yeah.
Okay, that answers my question, because I couldn't figure out how you would be able to contain it without it touching anything. So that answers that. So the production of antimatter is the next difficult thing for me. It's very expensive now, and you had mentioned the harvesting technique. And I think there was a paper about that recently, right, in harvesting antimatter in the solar system.
Right. There were two groups that did that work back in the day. I did the first work that I know of, and then Bickford MIT, had another concept where he was using magnetic funnel, and in my case, I was using a set of electrostatic nets that basically allowed the regular matter to go through but would trap the antimatter.
And how long would it take to build up enough antimatter for a trip to Proxima Centauri using that method?
Oh, I mean, for the purposes of what we were doing, the study was limited to a net that we could create and unspool in the back of the space shuttle. And so it was basically a small demonstration model. And so I forget the exact, I think it was, the netting was something on the order of a metric ton. And it could it basically reproduce Fermilab, so 2 nanograms per year.
Okay, and so that would have to be scaled up at some point to produce enough fuel for this trip, right?
Right.
Okay.
Now, in the meantime, we've realized that there are much, much more efficient ways to generate antimatter here on Earth. And so we're now looking at a facility where at producing 10 grams per year, so that's just a few years of production for a mission like this, it's only something on the order of $600 million a year for the operational cost. So, I mean, at a fraction of $1 billion a year for 3 years to make enough fuel to create an interstellar mission, that's chump change. If you look at how much Cassini costs, how much the Curiosity rover's costing, if you look at all those costs, they're all in the billions of dollars. And so, you know, something on the order of $500 million a year for a few years is nothing.
And where are these accelerator facilities now?
Oh, we'd have to build them.
Oh, okay.
But these are very, very small accelerators. So this is not, you know, the LHC at CERN or the Super Collider in Texas. We're talking about accelerators that fit in a room. So this is a very, very different scale.
Wow. Okay. Well, fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, John. Appreciate your call.
Okay.
Listeners, we're at, again, 1-866-687-7223. I have another email from you, and this is from Cal. I think this is the name, C-A-U-E. Maybe there's another way to pronounce it. If I'm mispronouncing your name, I really apologize. He says, about a year or so ago, there was an interesting discussion on the Space Show blog in response to Space Show programs with one Dr. John Brandenburg, a physics plasma physicist. And the question was about large nuclear bombs, but one of the blog participants brought up the fact that to do what you were talking about, not you, but what they were talking about on the blog, with a large nuclear bomb would not be possible, but maybe an antimatter bomb. And at that point, everybody just laughed and said non-existent. Could you make a weapon out of antimatter and harness it to being a huge destructive device?
No, not at all. Unless I made anti-uranium and made a antimatter nuclear bomb, right? Or enough anti-hydrogen and created an anti-hydrogen nuclear bomb. I mean, I suppose you could take the anti-hydrogen and put a regular conventional nuke around it and detonate that and create an anti-hydrogen, anti-deuterium and anti-tritium, compress that and cause that to fuse and make an anti-hydrogen bomb. I mean, I guess you could do that, but it would have the same destructive force as a regular hydrogen bomb. So what's the point? I don't think there's any benefit to that. It turns out that I probably shouldn't talk too much about this. My partner Steve Howe is actually much more the expert, since he actually built test bombs and detonated them in the Nevada desert.
Nevada test site.
Yeah, the Nevada test site. I mean, he's the one who actually did it. But it turns out it's very difficult to create a nuclear bomb. Okay, you have to have a neutron source. You have to initiate the chain reaction at a high enough rate that, you know, it'll explode before it just fizzles. And I don't see it happening. I would be much more worried about Breakthrough Starshot's lasers being used to incinerate cities by having it bounce off a metallic satellite like Telestar or something than I would about a bomb being made out of antimatter.
So, as I recall that blog discussion, I think it again stemmed from Star Trek shows where they said if they let the two matter and antimatter touch each other, it'll blow up the universe. So that's a gross exaggeration then.
No, matter and antimatter annihilation is only at the particle level. It's not at some existential level. And again, remember, the universe, I mean, our solar system is full of antimatter that's created when the cosmic rays strike the solar wind. And so this experiment of annihilating matter and antimatter is happening. It's been happening for 10 billion years, okay, or however old the solar system is. And so what we're doing is nothing novel compared to what nature's been doing for billions and billions of years. So if nature hasn't wiped out the existence of the universe yet, we're certainly not going to be able to do it.
Beth is in Seattle, and she said, I'm not grasping totally about antimatter propulsion. Would this be used to leave Earth's gravity field, or would you still be leaving Earth's gravity field with a chemical rocket and then using antimatter propulsion once you're outside of Earth's gravity field?
Well, certainly outside of Earth's gravity field. You would never, I mean, first of all, you can't create enough thrust to actually escape, to achieve escape velocity in the short distance between Earth and orbit. I mean, I'm a big fan of the TV show The Expanse. As I said before, I can't read, but I can watch TV shows. And hopefully by the time we're ready to launch such a thing, which, I mean, Congress wants this to launch in 2069, which is in about 50 years, okay? They want to do this at the 100th anniversary of the lunar landing. And so in 2069, I'm hoping by then we're launching most spacecraft from a lunar base. I hope that we're still not reliant on everything coming out of the Earth's gravity well by then.
Well, they also would like to see us go to the moon by 2024 or 2028, but I think we're going to miss that one too.
I hope not.
But I guess we will wait to see.
I must say, I took more when I exposed my daughter for the first time to 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Uh-huh.
She was so upset with me. She said, In the 1990s, you thought you were going to be able to do this by 2001. She goes, it's 2009, or she was 10 years old, so it was 2007. She goes, and we still haven't been able to do it. What the hell have you guys been doing all this time?
How did you answer her?
I said, it wasn't me.
Point the finger, huh?
Yeah.
Another question. Alex is in Denver, and he said, what advanced super fast propulsion might be plausible between nuclear propulsion and antimatter propulsion? Is there something else that would be an intermediate step between nuclear, which I wish we had, and antimatter? What is it?
Well, I mean, the big prize is fusion. Okay. I mean, what I'm doing with the antimatter is I'm catalyzing, basically, the antimatter is a spark plug that causes fission reactions, okay? There's another group of people out there, positron dynamics, where they're trying to use positrons to initiate fusion, okay? And again, so they're using antimatter to initiate a nuclear reaction, in that case, fusion. If somebody could get fusion to work, that gets you there, okay? The problem is we've been working as a species, we've been working on fusion now for 70 years, and we're no closer now than when we were in the 50s. There's a great book, for those interested, it's called Project Sherwood, and it's about the early days of the fusion program when it was still top secret, when it was classified, and they took some people from the Los Alamos Manhattan Project and put them over on fusion. And it's a great document because it describes the administration, the personalities, but also the physics of what was going on in the fusion program. And you look at the problems they're facing then and the issues they're facing, and you look at now, and it's the same. I mean, it's very disappointing how little progress we've made so far. So, yeah, someday if somebody could make fusion work, that would be nice. But we could be in a situation where 70 years from now we still don't have fusion. So, again, in my mind, fusion right now is a magic wand. Yeah, it would be nice if we could make it work, but it doesn't work. And so, for me, it doesn't make any sense employing a magic wand in something I'm trying to work on right now.
If we had fusion, what would the difference in speed be? So if your antimatter is 10% the speed of light, what would fusion propulsion allow us to do?
It turns out that even though you're talking about light nuclei and so on, it all conspires to be about the same order of magnitude. So it's about the same velocity. So it turns out that the exhaust velocity of these particles, it's about an MeV per nucleon, which turns out to be about 2.5% the speed of light. So whether it's fusion, whether it's fission, it doesn't really matter. You're right around 2.5-3% of the speed of light. So getting up to 10% of the speed of light with a spacecraft, or starting at 10% and decelerating down so that you could go into orbit and study as another solar system, means that you need a little more fuel. You need about 10 times as much fuel as this instrument package. But that allows you to get from this 2.5% of speed of light up to a ship velocity at 10% of speed of light through the rocket equation.
Henry's in Dallas, Texas, and I have a caller on hold for you. Henry says 10% the speed of light means that there's 90% of the speed of light still to go. Is there anything that would allow us to increase that velocity, or do you see 10% the speed of light as the maximum that we could probably get?
Okay, so looking at known physical mechanisms that we know about, that we've experimentally established, 10% a spacecraft at 10% of the speed of light. Now, this again means accelerating and then at the other end decelerating again. Looks like that's about it. Now, if you for those of you who ever read The Molten God's Eye, it's, you know, you certainly could have a laser on both ends, and then maybe you could actually get up to 25% of the speed of light. And then you use the laser in Proxima Centauri to decelerate again. But somehow you have to get everything there to build the lasers at Proxima Centauri. So either you have to wait, you know, a few centuries for that material to get there and to be self-replicated, or I don't see how you're going to make any of this happen any faster. And short of something like that, I think right now with known physical phenomena, 10% is probably kind of the maximum.
So reaching the speed of light is a physical impossibility, or just we don't know how to do it?
Well, nothing is ever at the speed of light except something that's massless, like a photon. So, I mean, I worked at Fermilab. I worked, you know, with particle beams that were operating at 99.9999999% of the speed of light, okay?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a proton, which was circulating in my storage ring, normally weighs a GeV. Well, it was 1,000 times heavier at that point. So it turns out that because of just special relativity. So and the faster you go, the more massive it gets, the particle gets, and therefore that much more energy is needed to accelerate even more. And you get into an exponential where, I mean, you just can't get there. So it's the same problem as, you know, you take a step forward, and then you take a half step forward, then a quarter step forward, an eighth step forward. At some point, you never make any progress anymore. And the same thing's true for approaching the speed of light. You never actually get there. And it's diminishing returns as you get closer and closer.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Just fine, I think. I'm trying to get kind of wrap my head around your numbers you're trying to suggest here. The amount of antimatter you need to create in order to induce this, you need basically one antiproton for uranium fission. Is that what you're suggesting?
Basically, yes.
Okay. And then how much antimatter do we need to achieve this propel this probe that we're talking about?
So it turns out that if you go through the numbers, because it is, okay, so the uranium is atomic mass of 238 and the antimatter is atomic weight of 1. So there is a divisor of 238 there. And so basically, round numbers, you're talking about on the order of 1/200th of the mass of the dry mass of the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. 1/200th. Okay.
Now there are ways to finesse that. If you look at the rocket equation, if you insist on 10%, you need a lot more antimatter than if you are okay with going at 5%.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And it's not just a factor of 2 or 3. I mean, it's a big number, big difference. And so you can modify your demand on the antimatter by how slow you're willing to go. And so one of my favorite examples is York Minster Cathedral. It took 250 years to build that cathedral, okay? There's nothing in writing that says we have to get to Proxima Centauri in 50 years, okay? I mean, nobody is dictating how fast, except for maybe the funding agencies, how fast you need to get there. I mean, the point is to get there in a reasonable amount of time, and everybody has a different definition of what reasonable means. Certainly back then in the Middle Ages, they thought that, or the Renaissance, I guess, they thought 250 years was a reasonable amount of time. And, you know, especially if you could discover things along the way. So, you know, on your way to Proxima Centauri, you're going to go through the Kuiper Belt, you're going to go through the Oort Cloud. So there are, you're going to go through the gravitational lens point of the sun. So there are things you can see along the way. So the question is, you know, what can you do? Can you justify such a mission with shorter term goals and returns so that you can get to the end point, which is visiting, you know, the nearest star system?
Yeah. Okay. I see where you're kind of going there. Essentially, your propulsion system, what you're trying to do is get something along the lines of, oh, like the old classic way back when Project Orion thing, but to do it on a practical level without actually having real nuclear bombs, and still going to do it on a microscopic level of inducing fissions in small amounts of uranium.
And doing it on a scale where the propulsion system has a mass comparable to the actual instrument package.
Yeah. I see. Okay, that part makes a lot of sense then, I guess. The way of practically making an idea like that practical rather than having this giant massive thing and
right.
all the wasted mass and the actual bomb components and stuff.
Right, and the shielding and all the other stuff that goes into that. And also, you're only when an atomic bomb goes off, you're only using a tiny fraction of the mass in the actual explosion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the total mass, because, yeah, you have this percent of the material that's reactive, plus you have the chemical explosive involved and all the other materials that are necessary and the structure and everything. We'll get into detail. I see what you're saying. That would be very inefficient, where this would be a very efficient use of the material that you're using for energy source and reaction mass.
Right. I mean, if you look at the history of antimatter propulsion over the years, then they started off with metric tons of antimatter being needed. And so with each successive iteration, you know, Bob Forward and all these other very smart people along the way, they've been able to come up ways to reduce the need for the antiprotons. So now we're just using the antiprotons as basically a spark plug. It's not the reaction mass. The uranium is the reaction mass.
Yeah. Okay. Now, one thing about I understand the idea you're trying to prevent sublimation. Are you going to have just like pellets? Of these anti-lithium coated anti-hydrogen, frozen anti-hydrogen.
Yeah, right. So an array of them, right.
An array of those pellets. And you're going to control the pellets then electromagnetically.
Right. Basically, the Millikan oil drop experiment is one way to do it.
Okay. And then essentially, when you want to react it, you'll somehow grab one of these pellets somehow and move it into some kind of a reaction chamber or something?
Yeah, I mean, initially it looks like all you have to really do is just hit it with a small beam of electrons, you know, like from a little vacuum tube. So you have a little thermionic emitter, just produce a little stream of electrons that will start annihilating with the positrons, heat up a little spot, and that will start boiling off the antihydrogen, and then that goes in and reacts with the uranium.
And
we could do all this with a positron beam going into a regular matter snowball and with a regular matter lithium shell. So, again, we could do everything on the flip side for very cheap.
Yeah. I definitely agree with your idea that the accelerators can be designed specifically to produce large quantities of antimatter at low energies because, you know, that would would be a lot cheaper than what we do for the high energy experiments, where we're trying to do something totally different.
Right.
Yeah, I got you on that. All right, on the whole other issue, I think when they were talking about the bomb thing, which isn't really a practical way to make a bomb for real purposes, but the idea is to react matter and antimatter to create the bomb, not to do an antimatter analog to one of our bombs, but rather just to push antimatter and matter in equal proportions together somehow. Isn't that what that
was? Okay, so let's take an example of liquid nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Liquid nitrogen, let's say you have a doer of liquid nitrogen and you throw it on a tabletop. Mm-hmm. What happens to that liquid nitrogen? Does it explosively turn into gas instantaneously?
No.
What, it just sits there, sizzles, and kind of boils above the surface of the table, of the countertop, right?
Right, yes.
Okay, so the radiation, in this case, for the matter and antimatter, the radiation pressure from the prior annihilations will keep the two separated. And so basically all it will do is it'll fizzle, but it will not explode. Just like if I take two pieces of uranium that are near critical mass and I bring them slowly together, they'll push each other apart. What was that called? Tickling the dragon, I think the early nuclear scientists called that, where they saw them push apart. Mm-hmm. So I think what will happen is it'll just sit there and fizzle, but it won't explode.
Yeah. Well, obviously you'd have to have it'd be the same problem you have anyhow would be how to bring them together to make them react rather than simply blow themselves apart almost instantly. It's not for real world weapons. It's not a practical choice. Obviously.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a lot easier to build an atomic weapon.
If somebody's worried about the disarmament, you know, arms control issues, that's not a real issue at all there on this, I don't think.
Yeah. See, what we're talking about is we're a victim of that book by Brown. What was the name of the where they blow up antimatter at the Vatican?
Yeah.
Or the angels and demons, I guess.
Yeah,
right? Right. We're a victim of that sci-fi.
Yeah, that was a little weird. Well, but the thing, I think what Brandenburg was discussing is a gigantically staged thermonuclear device. You know, like the idea of like the biggest Russian bomb they ever set off, where it was a three-stage device. You know, we use a fission bomb to drive a fusion bomb to drive an even bigger fusion bomb, and the idea to build a giant scale up of that.
Right.
So, he had some hostile alien force wanted to attack Mars for some reason.
Right. You know, the problem with it, again, maybe looking at this as a physicist, when you blow up a bomb, those particulates, the fragments of that bomb, are coming off at insignificantly small fractions of the speed of light. I mean, you're talking basically sort of, you know, speed of sound level velocities. You're nowhere near the speed of light. So even if you did do that, but just from the rocket equation, you're never going to get your ship up to anything near a fraction of the speed of light using it.
Right. Yep. You have a very interesting approach to this. I'll say that. Well, I'll clear the line.
John, I want you to wait because I'm going to read an email that came in while you're talking, and this is absolutely right up your alley. I'm almost hesitant to read it because it'll probably catch me hell on the blog for it. But this is, Doctor, this is from Carl in Atlanta, okay? And he says, I have a strange question for you, given that this show is about advanced propulsion, specifically antimatter and maybe a little bit about fusion. Recently in the news, the Navy has disclosed what they call tic-tac unusual aerial flying craft that have properties that do not seem to be of this earth, whether they're projection qualities, whether they're BS, nobody seems to know, but the Navy has said that the videos that they're showing from the F-18 Hornets are real and true and have not been edited. Can you imagine, with your advanced physics and properties knowledge, that there could be propulsion techniques or types or methods that are clearly unknown to our kind of physics that would allow something to go from 80,000 feet to under the ocean in less than a second. That was one of the properties witnessed by the F-18 Hornets. And the reason I asked John to stay on the line is because he absolutely loves this topic. So I guess he's asking you if you can imagine there could be advanced propulsion that we can't even contemplate or understand, given that the laws of the universe and the laws of physics are probably the same no matter where or what planet you might be on.
Okay, so, I mean, the history of physics is littered with people who thought that in their arrogance they understood everything. Okay, and so, Boltzmann actually committed suicide because he ignored quantum mechanics. And by the time he realized that quantum mechanics was correct, he was already so far behind, he knew as a theorist he'd never get caught up. And so he just committed suicide, okay? I mean, there are lots of examples where, you know, like Newton would be dumbfounded with special relativity and, you know, mass changing and speed of light being the limit and all this sort of stuff. Right now, and, you know, so back in the time of Boltzmann, everything looked like it was a nice, clean little package, except there was this little thing hanging out there called the photoelectric effect, which nobody kind of understood. And it was kind of an irritant in everybody's kind of mental model of how the world worked. Right now, we have another one of these little irritants, okay, and that is a particle entanglement, okay? And so it doesn't quite make sense. Why two particles at a long range should be instantaneously coupled so that when you flip one in state, the other one should flip at the same time? Probably, I mean, speaking as an Aborigine looking at an iPhone, my mental model is we're probably for the first time sensing a dimension outside of our own three dimensions. And we're, you know, these two entangled particles are actually a loop that are passing through our 3D membrane. And so, you know, this loop is spinning and the one particle is the spin inward and the other was the spin outward, if you can visualize in and out away from three dimensions. But the idea is that ring, if you ring that bell on one end, the other end rings also, and so the two particles are entangled. So could there be a whole new physics out there where we now see fourth, fifth, you know, 30th dimensions? Maybe, and then 100 years from now, that could be true. That could yield warp drive. It could yield time travel. It could yield a lot of stuff. My problem right now is, given the state of our... Okay, so imagine you're in charge of this population on an island, and there's a hurricane coming. Okay, you're not going to wait around for an iPhone to call for help. You're going to use whatever tools you have available and whatever know-how you have available to protect your rest of your society. Right now, my job as a rocket builder and as a physicist is to solve today's problems with tools I know exist today. I can't be sitting on my thumbs waiting for something to be invented that may or may one day be invented. It's pointless.
So you wouldn't rule out something really bizarre and unusual, but that's not part of what you can focus on today.
Right, because it's like worrying about something you can't control. All it does is generate an ulcer, right? Relying on something that may or may not someday be invented to solve a real-world problem today is kind of self-defeating.
Could your tools today be used to figure out the kind of propulsion of what the Navy is talking about with Tic Tac? I mean, would we even have the capability to understand those kinds of properties, in your opinion?
Well, certainly, now that we understand special relativity, quantum mechanics, all these other things, we're not nearly as, backward as, you know, some tribe in the Amazon looking up and seeing an airplane. I mean, at least we have some concept of what an airplane is now. So, I mean, we probably could ask better questions at this point. But, you know, who knows? I mean, let's say it is some alien civilization, and they're violating the rules because they're not waiting for us to achieve warp drive before they introduce themselves. I mean, at our current stage of development, we might have some better questions than we would have 100 years ago, but, I mean, are they 200 years ahead of us, 1,000 years ahead of us? Are they time travelers from a million years? Who knows? I mean, at some point, who cares? I mean, it's pointless.
John, I ask you to hold on because I wasn't sure Carl was going to do an adequate job of asking the question and may require some clarification from you since you understand this probably better than most Space Show listeners. Would there be anything you would add to that?
Well, I essentially agree with the general idea that what's being observed would appear to, if real, would be something that's beyond non. They have physical knowledge that we don't have. They've discovered something that we don't know of right now. To be my thought, it looks like they would have to have some sort of gravitational manipulation that is something that our current theories don't allow for, except for a certain guy named Jack Sephardi who thinks he's figured it out, but let's leave that aside for the moment. That's my general thought, is yes, it's advanced knowledge that would have to exist to explain this. And the thing I think about that is just that these kind of phenomena have been observed for quite a while now by some fairly credible observers, and that's why I'm interested in the subject. But yeah, whether we can really duplicate this with our technology, I think, is very dubious.
Now, that said, I do have to point out that often in these cases, it's a form of trickery. Somebody's trying to get attention, okay? I don't know if you guys remember Uri Geller, where he would go around bending spoons, and it took a physicist who was actually also a magician in his spare time, to actually point out the trick, and that it had nothing to do with mental powers, and it was just a trick. And in my career, I've actually served in some capacity for the Swedish Academy to dispel a Nobel Prize for a physicist who had a device that he claimed worked that nobody could figure out why it would work, because it was violating a bunch of laws of physics. And a couple of Nobel Prize winners at CERN actually brought me in, and the guy gave a talk in front of me, and I actually, in the span of about 10 minutes, figured out what he was doing. And I don't think he did it on purpose, but he kind of was self-delusion. He so wanted this to be true that he kind of thought it was true. And so because of this meeting in the middle of the night in Montreux, Switzerland, he didn't get the Nobel Prize, right? Because I identified what the trick was that he was using. And in the end, all the normal laws of physics were actually being applied correctly. So, I mean, yeah, you know, I answered the question initially in the spirit it was given, but more often than not, there's some level of trickery, or there's a misinterpretation of what you're seeing, or, you know, like crop circles, somebody's actually sending a beam of microwaves or doing something just to get attention.
Did you ever evaluate or look into the proposed M-drive propulsion system?
Oh, yeah. It's, well,
what are you?
I have to be careful. I don't know if the FCC controls my language here, but it's not going to be true. There's been a whole spate of these things recently. I mean, there was a NASA preprint that just came out with this propellantless propulsion system using relativistic beams that, he had a fundamental error in it, okay? And it just came out, last week? And then there was a fusion proposal that just came out a couple weeks ago that was in all the press. And that has a really obvious flaw also. So, I mean, for those of us who have this kind of broad experience and have kind of 40 years of experience in the field, it's often, you can see the holes in this, in these things. And the state of journal, I mean, present company accepted. Generally, the state of journalism is such that things are parroted without any real looking into them and critical analysis.
Yeah, yep. You can say that again. Hopefully present company exempted. So M drive, nothing there then, right?
No.
What about Mach thruster work? Are you familiar with what Dr. Woodward and others are doing with Mach thruster type of propulsion?
No, not really.
Okay. John, is that it for you?
Well, I guess that's it. I'll get off of these other subjects, but you're right. I mean, the established scientific knowledge would be have a negative verdict on these things, but you also have to look at the fact that there. The problem with the whole UFO subject in general is there's so much noise about it. There's so many false reports, misperceived things, that any real objects tend to get confused with all that stuff. Let's just put it that way.
You mean my abduction didn't happen?
Well, I don't know about your abduction, but. Well, I mean,
I'm just kidding, John. John, okay. I'm just pulling your leg.
but I'm saying that the amount of white noise in this is very high. I mean, it really is. And yet, I think like the Navy things are based on what they've actually are monitoring. And the problem we've had is, in my opinion, that the government has been very trying to keep all these things quiet for a variety of reasons. And that creates a lot more suspicion, so then you're in a world of who knows what. But now apparently they're talking about it in a strange way, but,
All right, let me move on, okay?
Sure thing.
Thank you very much, John. Listeners, there's still time if you want to get a call in, 1-866-687-7223. I have another email for you. This is from Dr. Jurist in Billings, Montana. And he says... I was hoping he would call too, but so far that hasn't happened. With spacecraft moving at a significant fraction of light speed, what about the additional radiation exposure coming from colliding with assorted charged particles and bremsstrahlung as the particles are swept up by the spacecraft? That is the mechanism that an X-ray machine uses to create X-ray. Is it negligible, or is the exposure highly significant at 10 to 30% of the speed of light?
Very good question. Very good question. So it turns out that 2.5% of the speed of light is MeV, okay? At about 5% of the speed of light, you're getting transmutation. So the protons are colliding with nuclei in your spacecraft, and you're getting PN reactions. So you're getting isotopic changes, and then some radioactive materials, you're getting decays, you're creating new elements. And so, yes, you are actually starting to get transmutation effects in your spacecraft. More importantly, you're getting charging of the spacecraft. And this is one place where, unfortunately, I have a big bone to pick with Starshot Breakthrough. They did a preliminary analysis where they said the amount of charging on the spacecraft was negligible. And they missed the biggest effect, which is the particles traveling through the sail. Which is still attached to the chip because they need the sail as the primary optics to be able to resolve the planet as they go by. That charging is orders of magnitude greater than the little bit of charging they initially calculated. There's a paper, if you look at X Archive online, I think the first author is Wong, who did this calculation. They missed the biggest effect. And so the implication of this is that as the spacecraft gets very highly charged to a very high voltage, that charge interacts with the galactic magnetic field and the trajectory of your spacecraft curves. And so if you're initially aimed at Proxima Centauri, you're going to miss by a long shot. My preliminary calculation says by hundreds of astronomical units. So you're nowhere near enough to ever photograph a planet or to do any science whatsoever. And since we don't know the direction of the magnetic field, who knows which direction you're going to go. So I think that and that's one case where, yes, there's a big effect. They did a very to their credit, they did a great analysis on dust particles and what the effect of dust particles was going to be on their chip craft. And so in their sort of mission video, they show the chip craft orienting itself edge-on to minimize the cross-section and the damage from such collisions. But, there is a big effect. But I think the most significant right now is charging.
And there's no way you can negate that or mitigate
it? Not with
it.
A milligram. There's no way you can create an electron. I mean, you need to eject particles and negate, you know, a sort of kilovolt to megavolt sort of voltages. I don't know how you do that in a square centimeter.
So if you're going slower, 10%.
You still get the charging, some charging effects.
But
it won't be as dramatic, and because the deflection goes as B cross V, so it's the velocity times the magnetic field. The slower you go, the less the curvature is. So the higher your velocity, the more extreme the charging is, and the bigger the force, the curvature force is. So you lose both ways as you get faster and faster.
Amazing. So that would sort of work against their 20 to 25% speed of light.
Right. I don't think they're going to get anywhere near that.
We're beyond the 90 minutes. Usually I would ask a guest, what have we missed? What is there more to talk about? I guess there's a universe more to talk to you about. We wouldn't complete it in the rest of the year.
One plea, and that is,
okay.
We're going to be launching another Kickstarter here pretty soon. Funding has been the big problem. I mean, basically right now I'm funding this out of my own pocket, and believe me, my pockets are threadbare as it is. I'm driving a 2002 car, okay? So, and I just sent a daughter to University of Michigan, right? So now, you can only imagine how much that costs.
Is that a Bentley you're driving, a 2002?
Yeah, right, I wish. So I mean, right now the big problem is that is funding. And so, you know, if people can keep their eyes open for, you know, it's not just me, but any of these projects. You know, all of us who are doing this sort of work are doing it on our own dime. I mean, once in a while we'll get a NIAC grant for, you know, $100,000, but that comes once a decade or once every few years. You can't have any sustained momentum with that, and you can't hire people because they don't want to quit their job and come work for you if they only have a job for a year. Right? And so,
right.
You know, when you see these sort of things, you know, Kickstarter has this nice space exploration portion to their website. So, you know, if you guys, you know, out there in the audience, you see people like us come up and ask for help, you know, $10, $50, whatever you can afford would certainly help, because right now, really, that's the only way any of this is getting funded.
When are you doing your next? You've already done one in 2017, and now you're doing another crowdfunding?
Yeah, I've got a high school student from Michigan who understands social media, and so he's setting up Instagram accounts, and he's trying to do this right this time. Last time we raised about $2,000, and, you know, I've been putting about $500 a month into this, and of my own money.
So when will your crowdfunding open up?
I would think probably around December or January.
So can I give you a little hint?
Yes.
Don't do it if your 30-day period for success is going to include Christmas and New Year's, because Kickstarter counts those holiday days as days on your campaign, except that people take a break from all of this stuff, and you're going to lose those days as being productive days of your campaign.
Yeah, so we'll probably wait until a little bit into the new year.
Yeah, so I would wait until after you know, January 1st in that period, so that you're not interrupted by national holidays.
Right. And I'll be speaking on this subject in Wichita, Kansas, in mid-November at the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop.
Well, if you will keep me notified with your plans, I'd love to bring you back on the show and talk about what you're doing with Kickstarter and continue this discussion with you about this technology and physics. It's fascinating, and you really are very generous to give of yourself and help us understand it.
Well, this was great. I enjoyed it.
Well, we enjoyed it, and I think we all, even me, learned an awful lot, and there's a lot more to learn, and you're a treasure trove and a great professor, so I hope we can talk to you a lot more. So let me know when you're about to launch your Kickstarter, and it'll be fun to bring you back on and talk some more with you, okay?
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Since I probably won't talk to you till early next year, a good holiday and Thanksgiving season to you, and great success with your propulsion work, and you have a lot of people pulling for you, so hopefully we can contribute and make it happen.
Great. Well, thank you. Take care.
Thank you, Jerry. And listeners, that's it. So remember, we have a program Monday night, Tuesday night, Hotel Mars on Wednesday, Thursday night, Friday morning, and Open Lines on Sunday. Really special thanks to Gerald Jackson for being with us today. Even more so for the ISDC folks and Dr. Zubrin having him there, because I would have never known about Jerry without Zubrin and ISDC. So when I talk about National Space Society and ISDC, man, they open up so many doors for people, and you just never know where things are going to come from. You just have to be on the alert, and I'm really grateful that I had a chance to hear him at ISDC and to meet him and bring him to the space show. Good night and goodbye, and happy rest of the weekend to all of you from Jerry David and the space show. Keep looking up. We'll be back tomorrow night.